You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston, tōki ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday, the 28th of February. My name is Jemima, and I'm your panellist for today. And I am joined from home, but they're out there, they're listening, by producers Charlie and Sam, who've put together some fantastic pieces for the show today from home. So we've got some good stuff coming up for you. If I akine, Charlie speaks to Yuri Goldoon, who is the chairman of the Ukrainian Association of New Zealand Northern Regions, about Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the peaceful protest that happened in Auckland over the weekend. She also speaks to Bindi Norwell, who is the CEO of ProCare, and they discuss ProCare's Mission Impossible initiative. And also, Charlie's been very busy today. She spoke to Green Party MP Chloe Swarbrick about the improvements to cultural infrastructure that are needed. And then Sam, who is doing his first official producing The Wire shift today, bit of a funny start from home, but you know, we're making it work in these conditions. Sam looks into the sociology of the anti-mandate protests taking place in Wellington, and he speaks to Professor Marcel Dawson from the University of Otago, and he also has a chat to some postgraduate students who say they would like a partial refund of fees as they start yet another semester online as we continue through this funny pandemic time. He aho o whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So te kapatu mai, you can send me through a text on 5395 or give me a call in studio on 309-3879. Also, after the show, koua e wariwari e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero ano hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga I te pae tukutuku o Irarangi Pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Do check it out. I also have some news at the end of the show that I'm thinking that I'll probably share today. So stay tuned in. There's some good stuff going on. Right, let's crack into it.
Irirangi Pōho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Russia's invasion into Ukraine continues, with Ukraine defending their nation whilst Vladimir Putin puts nuclear deterrence forces on high alert. Today is the fourth day of the invasion, with thousands of Ukrainian citizens having already fled across neighbouring borders. Many Ukrainians have stayed to fight against Russia as Russian forces continue to advance on Ukraine's capital, Kiev. On Sunday, a peaceful solidarity protest took place in Auckland's Aotea Square against Russia's military aggression in Ukraine. Yuri Goldoon, who is the chairman of the Ukrainian Association of New Zealand Northern Regions, spoke with Charlie about the protest and where New Zealanders sit amongst the travesty.
Yesterday in Auckland, there was organized an action, an event to protest against the war in Ukraine, and we were actually the organizers.
So what was planned for the peaceful protest?
Well, so to start with, we started planning that action 3 weeks ago, before the war broke. And we were counting probably on getting 20, 40 people around that protest, just aiming at informing the New Zealand society of what is going on in Ukraine. Because at that time, there was growing political tension. And that political tension didn't look well. But up to that time, when that protest actually took place, the war started on Thursday morning. And so people were aware, and we had a great attendance. We had not only Ukrainians, but representatives of other nations, some Chinese people, some Polish people, some Russians people came to support us. It was just great. So I think that we kind of fulfilled our task. Yeah, what was our goal? To let people know that we exist and that we want them to know we performed it quite well.
Do you think there was a lack of information being given to New Zealanders about what was happening in Ukraine before the protest took place?
New Zealand is a small country, and it is location on the outskirts of the world makes it reacting slowly. So I think that at this moment we have to encourage both New Zealand society and, first of all, probably government to act, internationally respond for the war in Ukraine. And please, when you write down your article, don't use the word conflict. It is not a conflict. It is a full-scale war. The pictures of that war is like from the Second World War. It's just horrible. So we are working at this moment to somehow connect or encourage the New Zealand government to act in political meaning and in economical meaning, and join the world in condemning those actions.
Do you think the government is responding well or enough so far?
No. We have prepared and sent a letter to the Prime Minister and to the Minister of Foreign Affairs 3 weeks ago. We have received an answer from the Prime Minister's office that they have received our letter, and they sent it to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and that's all. So nobody contacted us, nobody answered on our, not even a request, but our information. Guys, do something. But we didn't even receive any response from that.
Do you think there will be more protests or planned actions that will go ahead in response to that?
Yes, yes. I cannot tell you now when, because we just yesterday spent half a day in Auckland, and now there's heaps of follow-up actions. We met many people. We met huge support. Many people offer their personal support, their financial support. So there's huge follow-up, and we would have to work with it, and then we will see when we can plan next protests.
To people who are wanting to offer aid, is there a particular place that's best to go and do that?
Obviously, yes. I'm aware that at this moment, already UNICEF has announced its actions. Red Cross works on it. That's the international organizations. Also, our organization, which is called Ukrainian Association of New Zealand, you can find us on Facebook. We also organize some financial support. That is what we can do now.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to New Zealanders about the issue?
Yes, I can. And this is very important. New Zealand, as I said, feel safe, because it's traditionally far away from everybody. But it's not the truth. Ukrainian example is a lesson for every country and every nation. And we have to start thinking about that. we are not guaranteed from something like that happening in the observable future. And we have to start understanding it. We are a little nation, and it will take 2 days for New Zealand to be subdued. And it's not science fiction. We also thought that something like that is impossible in the modern world. But as you can see, it is possible. We thought that political tension is political tension. Okay, politicians have its own world and its own vision. Let them work on it. Let them keep together, get together, let them discuss, maybe put pressure on each other. But throwing bombs on children, on houses, in 21st century, we would never, ever have imagined it. But it's happening now.
That was Yuri Goldoon, the chairman of the Ukrainian Association of New Zealand Northern Territories, speaking with Charlie about their response to what is happening in Ukraine. Please take the time to support the aid causes that Yuri has discussed.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
The anti-mandate protests in Wellington have been going on for nearly 3 weeks. Here is Sam's piece, first piece for the Monday Wire on this issue.
The anti-mandate protests in Wellington have been going on for nearly 3 weeks now. They're becoming increasingly problematic with residents and reporters being threatened. New Zealand has a long history of protests, and this is the most widely covered protest since the 1981 Springboks tour. But what makes these anti-mandate protests different? I spoke to sociology professor Marcel Dawson from the University of Otago. She specializes in social movements and popular protest. So first of all, how would you describe these protests and would they qualify as a social movement?
I would very clearly and definitively say they are not a social movement. I see them as a sort of a combination of illegal and legal protest action. You know, on the surface, if we look at it, the central demand that this group is making seems to be about an end to vaccine mandates. But to me, I sort of see that as, I can compare it to a child asking or demanding something now that they were going to get anyway if they were just willing to be a little bit patient. I mean, if we look at this parliament occupation, what do we think is actually going to happen when these people get what they want or maybe don't get what they want? In my view, I think they're just going to go home. And if you compare that to a movement, what we see is that there's sustained action towards a broad goal. Now, for some movements, they might have or might win piecemeal gain, so smaller sort of easy wins along the way to some broader social shift. And we would call this, you know, social reform or transformation. Sometimes it can also be in the form, more rarely, but it can happen that it's radical change. So it changes society quite suddenly. And we would see that as a revolution. Now, personally, amongst these groups who are occupying parliament, I don't see them as transformative and I don't see them as revolutionary. So to answer your question, no, I do not see them as a social movement.
Do you think that the global sort of influence on these protests changes anything? Like there's a similar one, as you know, in Canada and that
Canada,
kind of thing.
Yeah, and elsewhere. And I think it's given the appearance of transnational solidarity. But again, I think that the basis for this is really, really flimsy. If you look at other transnational protests, like School Strike for Climate, like Black Lives Matter, there's a lot more going on there that holds that group together. In these groups, whether it's Canada, whether it's New Zealand or elsewhere around the world, where we've seen these kinds of anti-mandate protests, there's not a lot of ideological coherence in these groups. You know, that if we look at just in our own country, there are Trump supporters hanging out with you know, natural immunity folks, and then there's the anti-vaxxers and the my body, my choice folks who brought their kids along, who clearly the kids have no choice in what they're doing. So I think it's just, it's not about diversity. Most movements, most successful movements are diverse in terms of the people who are supporters of the movement. The key problem for me here is ideological coherence, or the lack thereof, that we're seeing amongst this group occupying parliament ground. So yeah, I get the point that there seems to be transnational solidarity, but I think it rests on very, very flimsy grounds.
And do you also think that the involvement of white supremacists at the protest changes any potential concerns that people are having in the protest?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, it makes it a little bit more risky. It's a volatile group, and I think this is partly why police have been quite cautious in their actions. It's not just a single type of group that you're dealing with here. I think, you know, in protest, there's always a kind of element of opportunism. And so to me, the kind of more alt-right groups have kind of hijacked the attention that the anti-mandate groups are getting. So yes, it's a cause for concern, partly because of the tendency towards much more illegal action, but also for the people who are legitimately protesting there, that actually detracts from what they're actually trying to do. So it is quite concerning to a whole lot of different elements, regardless of, you know, how you're coming into this protest or how you're looking at it. That group is, they can be quite divisive, so they certainly aren't helping the cause.
These people who may be misinformed, but could also be genuinely concerned, how can we reach them and make sure they have the correct information that will protect them from COVID?
I mean, I guess the starting point is to say, you know, who is we? Because if we start to actually answer it, you know, is it the media? Is it the government? Is it scholars or academics like myself? And I don't think it is solely up to us to go out and find these people or these voices that are getting silenced by these other more vocal protesters. I do believe it is up to these people who believe that they have a genuine concern to organize and mobilize from a position of strength. At the moment, you know, they seem to have fallen in with this ragtag group of disaffected people who have no clear goal, no coherent ideology. They haven't done the mahi. You know, if you look at protest action around the world, to become sustained, so, you know, the key difference between a protest and a social movement rests on the idea of sustained action. And I don't think that this group has done the background work to sustain their efforts beyond what they're going to get or what they don't get out of these actions. They, you know, if you look at sort of protest action, if it becomes sustained, there's usually sort of a whole history going on. I mean, Black Lives Matter, the school strike for climate, those things aren't just expressions of the 21st century. We might have seen them spilling out and you know, we see them in the papers as these contemporary things. But if you trace it back, these two movements have very, very long histories of struggle. Black Lives Matter could be traced back to the civil rights movement. School strike for climate could be traced back to the environmental movement of the 1960s and beyond. So these things are representative of sustained action, where you've kind of got generations worth of history, memory, effort, etc., that newer groups can kind of tap into and extend, or you know, it kind of gives them a resurgence or a renaissance if they're able to pick up from where previous efforts and previous generations have left off. I don't believe this group has done the work.
That was Professor Marcel Dawson from the University of Otago speaking about what makes a social movement and why the Wellington protest is not one.
Can anyone explain why the modern day Wales are so big?
The Wire.
You're on the Monday Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima. I'm panelling the show today. Producing the show from home today is Charlie and Sam, and they're both doing an awesome job. If you have any thoughts on the pieces on the show today, do send us through a text. 5395 is the number. The COVID-19 pandemic has seen an increase in stress among medical staff, with the new Omicron outbreak putting even more pressure on New Zealand's health systems. A new initiative launched by ProCare called Mission Possible hopes to help relieve some pressure off medical staff and practices by offering extra assistance to administration duties. Bindi Norwell, who is the CEO of ProCare, spoke to Charlie about their new initiative and similar work done by ProCare amidst the pandemic. Charlie started by asking, what is Mission Possible?
So Mission Possible is an initiative launched by ProCare, given the sheer amount of pressure on the healthcare system at the moment, on general practices and healthcare professionals who have been inundated with patients seeking care at the moment, given the rise in Omicron.
So is this initiative available for like care homes, individual help, or more like hospital-based?
So it's available for those general practices and healthcare professionals that are part of the ProCare network, and there's around 170 practices across Auckland. And what we're doing is really just getting rising to the challenge just to support them where we can. So, for example, we're delivering things such as RAT tests. We're supporting calling their patients that actually need other healthcare attended to, for example, immunisations, so we don't keep up with the healthcare requirements. We'll help them with, troubleshooting IT issues as well, with their systems and phone systems being off the hook. So it's just around everything we can do to help, just to get through absolute pressure on the system at the moment.
So how many people do you think will be involved in the Mission Possible system?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the timing, really, but we've got teams that, are supporting across our organisation. So whole teams will be going out to support practices. So, for example, that usually work in areas such as our Ready, Steady, Quit team, who are helping smoking cessation. Now they're actually going out to help our practices as well. They're keeping up with their day jobs as well, but if they've got spare capacity, they'll be going out to visit them. We've got head office, for example, our technology teams are supporting. We've got our operations teams that are delivering products out to them. So it's really across company initiative here.
So was this something that was designed more when New Zealand was in phase two, or do you think it will be still very beneficial in phase three, even though less people may be isolating?
We're just really going to take it as it comes, really, because, it really will depend on the actual needs and, with the new levels, it might relieve some of the pressure, depending on whether, people need to get tests or, it's making sure that also people know that they can self-isolate at home and they really only need to seek medical support and see their GP if they're really experiencing difficulties or they've got a pre-existing condition. So most majority of people can self-isolate at home and be quite safe.
Has ProCare done any similar work to this before?
Yeah, we're constantly supporting our network and healthcare professionals, but this is actually just an initiative to do everything we can in our power right now to make sure we're focusing on the right things. So, for example, it's making sure we're doing really practical things for our practices that, it really helps them with their day-to-day pressure. Obviously it's changed with things such as delivering rapid antigen tests and, it just depends what's required at the time. So, look, we are here to support the network and healthcare professionals. We know how hard they're working. We know what pressure they're under. They're absolutely exhausted, some of them, just keeping up with Omicron and also looking after their patients generally and their health. So, I think this is just a call to action. I'm really proud of our team, how they've just stepped up to rise to the challenge too.
Is there a timeline for this initiative as well, or do you think it will extend quite far into the future?
Well, it depends on Omicron, really, and how much, you know, we've got increases in people actually getting infected. But I think we're probably thinking it's going to be a few weeks, but we'll assess after that. We've still got our business to run. We've still got a day job on top. But we'll do what we can to support, you know, how long we need to do it.
So what else does ProCare do for the medical community?
So ProCare supports the network of general practices and healthcare professionals. We've also got a very large mental health division, Fresh Minds. We also have who are providing psychological support for people across the community. We also have a partnership of CareHQ, which is a virtual general practice, which is really providing support in the community at the moment where people can't actually travel to go to their general practice. We've got a huge, you know, number of initiatives across health as well. So, yeah, it's we do a lot.
Have you seen any of those specific sectors sort of increase in the need for help regarding COVID just in general?
Yeah, we've been targeting a lot on vaccinations as well and boosters, particularly Māori and Pacific communities. And so it's really, we've got a new initiative where we've launched a mobile van as well, vans that can actually go out to churches, can go out to marae, and areas where people can get treated for health. And so it's about taking health out to the people in the communities as well and liaising with other key stakeholders to make sure we have a holistic support around families as well. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on. It's never a dull moment.
Have the public reacted well to the initiatives that ProCare have brought?
Yeah, the public have, particularly when we go to a church or to a marae or to a for vaccination centres. Absolutely, you know, it's about increasing awareness and communicating where support is available. And we've had some great success stories as well. We really encourage people to come along, not only to get vaccinated, but also have their health treated as well. So I think, yeah, we've had some really good response, really positive feedback. I'm just so proud of our team, how we've really stepped up, but also I'm so proud of all the healthcare professionals that are out there at the moment that are just going over and above to support patients. It's been a really tough time. It's been a very unprecedented time. It's amazing how people just collaborate to get things done. And we have seen results. We have seen, you know, these initiatives having impact on our communities and population.
That was CEO of ProCare, Bindi Norwell, speaking about their new initiative to aid health staff through the Omicron outbreak.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
It's the first week back for many University of Auckland students. As announced earlier this month, all classes will be online. Students say they would like a partial refund of fees as they won't have access to facilities due to Omicron. I spoke to two postgrad students about beginning another semester of online study. Here is Amy, who is finishing her honours in physiology. Have you been happy with the approach that the university's had to online study?
Definitely not. especially with honours, which is quite sort of hands-on, so most of the postgrads would feel the same, whether it's master's, PhD, whatever. But being remote, kind of, it's not really an option, and they didn't really take a lot of effort to try and see if there was any way around it for us. So oftentimes if they sort of went like, well, can you work from home? It was like, yes, but it's not ideal. They were just like, okay, work from home.
What adjustments do you think would have made it easier, more like you were doing it in person?
I mean, one of the main ones was sort of access to my supervisors. So they gave us the initial 2-month extension, sort of as a COVID extension, but I don't think they realised that still in that 2 months, which went over Christmas and New Year's, we weren't going to have access to our supervisors or any of the resources on campus. I still didn't have any access to them, or I wasn't able to work with them or work on campus. So that the 2 month extension, while it was sort of considered sort of generous, it sort of didn't help much because our access to them was still like massively limited. So, I mean, I was really lucky to get granted the secondary extension, but again, it's the same thing. I still don't have any more access to them because they've still got other students to look after as well. Like, I'm not the only priority, and like my main supervisor also has kids who, obviously with COVID world, they're mostly at home. So I don't think a lot of consideration was taken into that sort of side of it. Like, outside of uni, lives still go on, but I didn't seem to take that into account.
And would you consider further study under these online conditions?
I was sort of not given much of an option because the end of my honours study would overlap with this year's learning year. But I've been given a place in a master's course starting next year, and I'm very much still on the fence with it. So, I mean, it's a master's of physiotherapy as well, so a lot of it would be hands-on. So remote learning just, it doesn't really cut it anymore. I mean, I missed out on so many labs in the last 2 years that it's just sort of, it's almost not worth it to be paying full fees. I mean, a lot of the lab costs weren't deducted from our fees in the last couple of years, which seems a bit ridiculous considering we weren't able to use any of the labs. And then like all the student services fees are still the same, even though, you know, we're not using any of the facilities at the uni.
Should the university consider refunding that portion, at least the like levies for the buildings and using the labs and that kind of thing?
I mean, I would have thought so. It just seemed really odd that the fees didn't change when, as soon as they sort of said we were going online. It did seem quite odd. I mean, in my third year at the beginning, there was a little bit of, half of it was online. Some of us ended up having some labs, some didn't. So, and they did give some of us the opportunity, if we missed out on a lab, just to say, when we were open up, you can come back in. But it's like that year of study would already have been well finished and you'd have to find time to go in and do them. So to use that as kind of an excuse to not refund seemed really strange. But now that before a semester starts, they've been making sort of big, bold rulings that there's going to be no on-campus study, I think they probably should refund that. It doesn't really make sense not to. If the resources aren't being used, then it kind of makes no sense to charge students with it.
And I also noticed, or just in the announcement, I'm not sure what they've told you guys since, but they said there would be like some use of the facilities for students, but what has it actually been like, and like this latest Omicron alert level?
Most of it's been sort of, you get the feeling that it's very much exceptional circumstances. So particularly in my lab, which is the exercise science department down in Newmarket, we're quite a small lab as well. So you'd think that given that we have so many rooms and everything at the lab, you'd be able to sort of socially distance safely, and we'd be able to go in, and all of the office space is pretty well partitioned. But they've said you can only really go in for exceptional circumstances. All of our meetings are online. It just seems a little odd that even part of the university that is quite sort of remote from the main campuses and has got quite good separation within the lab itself, it seems really odd that we're still not really allowed to go in or use any of the facilities.
And secondly, nearing Tim, who is studying a master's in architecture. But are you happy with the current approach to online uni?
Like, it's very kind of difficult, I guess, because in a way, like, it's probably the safest option, but I think, especially for postgrad, like, thesis at the moment, like, what I'm doing, like, I'm very limited to, like, my own facilities. Like, I literally just have a laptop, and I rely solely on university facilities, especially for, like, design and architecture, like, the more creative courses. Like, I will go into uni every single day to use the computers because my laptop can't run software and like that's what we're paying for. Like I'm literally just paying like eight or nine grand a year to work at home. And like the studio space as well, like you get like lockers and like a whole range of like equipment and stuff. Also the workshop is really important for architecture, the downstairs workshop. We like model make, like using all the tools and stuff, like the machines for like woodwork. And we do like metal, like welding and stuff as well for architectural models. But I think for some, I think maybe about opening up studio for some people, but it's just like a lot of, like the university is saying like, no, like we don't really want people coming in. Like last year, even though like the case numbers weren't that high, like they didn't even let us come to the library. They didn't let us come and get our like models or anything from our lockers in studio to present our final like assignments, which is like really fucked up. So a lot of our assignments and projects were like compromised. Like it wasn't to the best ability because we didn't have resources available for us. But I think with my projects, if I was to spend my time at home, like it wouldn't be to my best potential.
Do you think there's another, like there's another way around it that the uni could do?
I guess it's like in a way, say like first to third years compared to like post-grad, the cohort is like a lot smaller, so there is like a better opportunity to meet up privately, or especially like in thesis where you just have a supervisor, so it's kind of up to the supervisor's like opinion if they would like to meet face to face, which like I think a lot of supervisors do, but it's also really hard. So I'm going back to uni like next, like on Wednesday, but I'm still in ISO, so it's like everyone's meeting face-to-face, and then I'm going to be one of the kids that's on Zoom that no one cares about because the class is too loud and no one cares about you. Because I've been in that situation before where, like, I'm in class and people are on Zoom and you just, like, you just forget they're there.
That was postgrad students Amy Hurst and Nearing Tim talking about their experience with online uni.
Thank you so much for that one, Sam. You're on The Wire on 95BFM. We've got one more piece for you after this that Charlie produced with Green Party MP Chloe Swarbrick on cultural infrastructure, so do stay tuned. We'll be right back after a short break. Here is A Real Thing by The Beths. You're on 95BFM.
Oh, Hey, it's Doug here with the Little Kalimba. The Broadcasting Standards Authority wants your views on proposed changes to broadcasting rules. They help ensure freedom of expression without harm on radio and TV. Submissions close on 8th March 2022. For more details, go to bsa.gov.nz.
Crispness, browbone, prestidigitation. These words and more available now at UBIC, your one-stop shop for textbooks, stationery and all your general literary needs. Course-specific words like gestalt and rhizomatic, all-time classics like chess and hello. Get your semester one course books and more at UBIC. Big words, big emotions. Pop in store Monday to Friday, 8:30 to 5:30 at number 2 Alfred Street or online at ubiq.co.nz.
Gang of Four. Gang of Four. Every Friday night, BFM's got you covered for the best tunes to preload to. With a revolving cast of BFM's favourite long-serving selectors, it's the Gang of Four. With Renee Jones, Pat Five, Phil Armstrong and The Professor. Gang of Four. Friday, 7 to 9pm on 95BFM.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
2 weeks ago, Green Party MP Chloe Swarbrick delivered an open letter to Infrastructure Minister Grant Robertson with solution suggestions for cultural infrastructure. The suggestions were made to ensure that venues, businesses and individuals who suffered a high amount of loss during the pandemic would not experience the same issues again. The Green Party acknowledged in a press release last week that they welcomed the targeted support for the arts community that was announced by the Minister of Finance. Chloe Swarbrick spoke with Charlie today about the open letter, with Charlie first asking what the proposed solutions of the open letter were.
So there were four proposals that were put forward, one of which was enabling Auckland Council to, for example, waive or delay charges for things like licensing fees and to simplify processes for applying for example, outdoor dining, which of course, as we move through the next stages, is going to become increasingly important. Also to provide targeted support, that one of course we ended up winning, to ensure, thirdly, that there was a capacity or ability to negotiate commercial rent reductions and also to extend, fourthly, IRD and government-backed loan schemes. So we ended up winning two of those four demands. Unfortunately, with the targeted support being provided, while that, of course, was awesome and has been a lifeline for many of these institutions, the big problem is that unless there is the facilitated commercial rent reduction negotiations, then it very well may be the case that the subsidy just ends up being eaten by the wallet of commercial landlords.
And so would this just apply to Auckland City or would this be extended further?
So the ask came about by virtue of my position as a local MP for Auckland Central and realising, speaking to a number of, you know, our kind of venues and our kind of restaurants and the holes in the wall and our owner-operators, that this was a particularly acute issue for Auckland City Centre, particularly given the compounding effects of the 107-day kind of lockdown at the end of last year and obviously also the fact that we as a city centre have a far greater density of people who, for example, typically in normal times, not that I think we're anywhere near those now, but operate out of those office blocks kind of 5 days a week. So while it very much was focused from the position of Auckland Central, it is something which applies across the country. So the outcome that we saw, the one which I think is kind of the headline issue, is for those who have experienced a 40% decline in their revenue, they are eligible for targeted support.
And is the current infrastructure for cultural spaces in Auckland, like, specifically insufficient in certain ways?
Hugely. Look, you know, I first got involved in politics back in 2016 when I ran in the local government elections. And this is a good shout out to anybody who's really interested in the future of our city, because it's local government elections this year. Please do put yourself out there and fight for the things that all of us love about our city, and to make these spaces more available, accessible, better funded, and therefore more vibrant. But it was the closure of the King's Arms for me, or, you know, the foreshadowed closure of the King's Arms in 2016, which really led me to first kind of stick my neck out into the political arena. It was at that point in time where it became really abundantly clear that we simply haven't put in place the systems or the structures to support our venues in particular, or our cultural infrastructure at large, which is really bloody important for example, a flourishing local music scene where bands and artists can get a foot in the door, try things out without, you know, risking absolutely everything and being able to make mistakes, build an audience and a name for themselves. So, you know, if we really want to do those things, then we have to look at these spaces which are available and accessible, but we also have to look at the surrounding infrastructure, for example, our public transport. We also have to move away from a model of particularly live music that currently relies far too much on alcohol sales.
And for the proposals that were made and the achievements that that got, have you had a good response from businesses or individual artists?
Yeah, in terms of the cultural infrastructure letter to the minister, obviously the fact that, you know, there was 60 signatories on the original letter, including some kind of headline orgs like Save Our Venues, but also The Realness, which operates and works with owner-operators and kind of restaurants and cafes and otherwise, a number of different kind of small businesses, including Metro Restaurant of the Year, Peachy, which opened at the start of the pandemic at the mouth of St. Kevin's Arcade. You know, all of these people who do their best to make our kind of contribute to our community, to employ locals and serve locals and ensure that when we come out the other side of this pandemic, that we're not walking back out into like a corporate wasteland, but into the things that we know and love about this city. So yeah, I think that we can count that as a success with 60 plus folks signing on to the original open letter. Subsequent to that, we had 1,300 people sign on to the open letter on the website, and obviously we've seen the minister subsequently respond to 2 out of those 4 asks. But I think the key point remains for both those who are commercial tenants, but actually also, to be frank, those who are residential tenants, that landlords across both commercial and residential sites are really putting the squeeze on the people who, you know, have contributed to the art and the culture and the vibrancy of this city. And it's really important that we start to think seriously and maturely about the kind of controls that we want to put in place as we mature as a city.
And you mentioned just before at the start of the interview that you didn't want this subsidy to sort of just be eaten up by the big commercial companies. Is there any way that that can be avoided?
So, yeah, a few different things to note there. When it comes to this resurgence kind of support payment scheme, the threshold now being at 40% means that the catchment is far more targeted. And I've got OAO documents from a cabinet decision made back in October around the supports that were made or put in place, rather, during the August Delta lockdown for us in Tāmaki. So as far as that goes, it is far more targeted than the previous 30% threshold. But when you're talking about it being swallowed up by those kind of commercial entities, I think the most important thing to pay attention to here is those commercial landlords, who, of course, have also experienced a massive historical record increase in the capital value of their properties over the last 2 years as a result of the government's over-reliance on what's called unconventional monetary policy.
And so for future infrastructure, is there any sort of vision on how you think it would be best appropriated for these outbreaks?
Yeah, I think it's really important to figure out how we can segregate the two different issues of what we do in a crisis versus what we do in normal times. I've personally found it a little bit frustrating that when we hear in the mainstream this call for whatever the new normal looks like, that the new normal is often manifest as being used to this pandemic becoming endemic and perhaps wearing our masks a little bit more or getting vaccinated more regularly, as opposed to reflecting on the fact that the normal that we've come from was entirely unsustainable, particularly if we wanted a flourishing local arts and cultural scene. So I prefer that we start up that conversation again about what do we want the future to look like? What lessons can we learn about the past in terms of the subsidies and supports that we have provided for our local industries and our local people to not only get a foot in the door, but to make really cool stuff, the kinds of things that we are proud of. And I think, if anything, the silver lining of the pandemic has showed us the importance of that localism, the importance of our communities, and the importance of supporting creativity in our own backyard.
That was Chloe Swarbrick, Green Party MP, speaking with Charlie about improvements and developments being made for cultural and arts-based infrastructure in Aotearoa.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the Monday Wire for another week. Big thank you to you for tuning in and listening to the show, and also for sending through your texts. We always love to hear what you've got to say on The Wire, so always keep that rolling in for the news team. Massive thank you needs to go to Charlie and Sam for producing a very chocker awesome show for the first week of semester, which is really exciting. You'll have Charlie and Sam on Monday Wire for the rest of the semester, so that's all good and super exciting. We will also have a whole bunch of different teams on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday Wire, so look out for some new voices. It's going to be really exciting. Some new voices reading the news as well. So send in through some encouraging texts if you ever feel like somebody's doing a really good job. That's always nice to hear from us. Well, we hope you have a good afternoon out there and that you're taking care of yourself, and that if you're in isolation that you're going okay. Keep listening to BFM. Up next is Penny with the 1-4, but you've got a sort of a song in between then and now, so just chill and keep listening to BFM. Catch you soon.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.